The next matter on for oral argument this morning. The next matter on for oral argument this morning is Bowdish versus Dart X, Inc. and the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Council, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to the relator, if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. The timing limitations are indicated in the light and the clock in the podium, or and you can raise or lower the lectern to your height at your convenience. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. Counsel for relator, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Michael Fargioni. I'm the attorney for the relator, Patricia Bowdish. The case is before the court on a writ of certiorari following a final determination by an unemployment law judge, David Gibson. Here's the issue. The unemployment law judge found, as a matter of fact, that Patricia Bowdish, who's a commercial truck driver, was negligent. Her negligence was a direct cause of a collision between her, her rig, the 18-wheeler, and a train. This occurred on the property of a customer, Sappy Paper Company, that was internal to the company up in Cloquet as she was trying to exit. The legal issue is whether or not that behavior, that negligent action on the part of this driver, constitute misconduct. And that is a legal issue that the court reviews de novo. The basic argument here
So you're not disputing the negligence finding. You're disputing whether that negligence meets the misconduct standard.
We don't disagree with the agency judge based on the legal standards and the deference you give to the judge at the unemployment hearing. There's no question that he found there was negligence, and there's evidence in the record that we would have to accept. We might disagree with it, but for our purposes here, the starting point is this driver was negligent. She didn't see a train coming when, by exercising due care, she could have. So the material facts that we go through are, we're about a year ago, January of 2018. She's on the Sappy Paper Company property. She's got a load with 48,000 pounds on it, 24 tons. She's trying to exit the property to go back to Wisconsin with her load. She has to cross a series of railroad tracks. She goes across one, going about 10 miles an hour. She's coming to a second set of tracks. Sappy has elected not to put stop signs at these railroad tracks. So they're relying on the carefulness of the driver to keep a good lookout and to discern when trains are coming. There's nothing automatic. They don't have to stop at the tracks. There's no stop sign. The difficulty in coming to the second set of tracks is when she looks to her left to look at the tracks, there's a partially obstructed view, and the unemployment judge acknowledges this in his decision. But he also finds that someone who's exercising due care can see, despite this partially obstructed view, if a train is coming. Ms. Bowdish did not see the train coming until she got past this obstruction.
You don't dispute, are you disputing that fact finding, that a person who engages in ordinary care would have seen the train coming?
We have no basis for that, Judge. There's testimony in the record to support that. So the unemployment law judge had a basis for finding it, and we have to defer, all of us have to defer to that. So, and there's an explicit finding by the judge that if she had looked more carefully, she would have been able to stop. This is an avoidable accident. A driver exercising due care would be able to stop. So based upon the definition that's in the statute at 268.095 subdivision 6 that defines what's misconduct, Part A says a single negligent act that adversely affects the employer can be misconduct. And that's basically what the judge found, explicitly citing that provision of the law. The difficulty, and in reviewing it de novo, we're drawing your attention to subdivision 6B, which starts out by saying, notwithstanding what's in subdivision A, the following acts are not misconduct. So these are explicit provisions in the statute. Two of them are relevant in this case. The basic one is subdivision 6B, part 6, that says if you're doing a job that requires the exercise of judgment, a good faith error in judgment is not misconduct.
Now, that was where I was troubled with your argument, so help me out here. What were the collision contributing judgment calls that were within your client's discretion as it applies to this good faith exception?
She made the judgment that there was no train coming when she was behind that building. And until she got past the building, when she could then see this train without obstruction, it was too late to stop because she was too close to the track. So the error in judgment was, I'm behind this building, I look to my left, I don't see anything. I make the judgment that it's safe for me to proceed because there's no train coming. And that was wrong. That was an error in judgment.
How is that a discretionary judgment within any employee's field of decision-making? That you are allowed to choose to drive the equipment over the tracks without checking to make sure there's no train at a point where you would be able to ascertain that a train is or is not coming.
Your phrasing of the question is mistaken, Judge.
All right. Help me out.
Well, you're saying she didn't look. What the judge said here is if she had looked more carefully, she would have seen the train. He never found that she didn't look. Her testimony directly is that she did look. The last part of the transcript would summarize page 44 of the transcript. She looked. She just didn't see it. We cited three cases that are related to statutory immunity that are virtually identical, where this court for the past 20 years has said a municipality, the government, doesn't have to pay somebody who's hurt if someone makes a mistake in judgment.
Or is it discretion?
Yes, a discretionary act for the statutory immunity. But it's common law principles that are embodied in the statute. And there's no definition of what an exercise of judgment or exercise of discretion would mean. There's no statutory definition. It is common law. What is an act of discretion, an act of judgment? The three cases cited, the one that is most clearly on point, probably because there was a dissent in it, it explains a little bit more what was made, the Kelly versus Jurdish. This is one that happens, I think that's the one in Scanlon, where a guy just goes through a stop sign and causes an accident. He said, I didn't see it coming. If I had seen it coming, I would have stopped. I didn't see it coming. That's what. And the facts in that case, I mean, the district court said there was no immunity because it was not a discretionary act, and this court reversed because, assuming that what the plaintiff said is true, that this was an act of negligence, someone who's paying attention would have seen what Judge Peterson said in that if he had seen the car, he would have stopped. He would have exercised a different judgment. He didn't say this was not an act of judgment. In fact, the explicit holding is the opposite. There was immunity where the municipality didn't have to pay precisely because it was an act of discretion. It was a judgment call. The same thing happened in Minneapolis when the guy went through a red light down on Washington Avenue. There was a partial obstruction. He didn't see someone coming. He caused an accident. Same thing happened in Wabasha County. Someone goes through a stop sign, pulls on the Highway 63 that has where the person has the right of way, and causes an accident because he didn't see the person coming. In each of those three cases, this court ruled that was a discretionary act, was not a ministerial duty. And we got the same thing here. There's no stop sign. There's no violation of any rule. There's no violation of any speed limit. It's simply a judgment call that was a mistake. I didn't see the train.
I think in your brief you did not cite any cases arising under this provision in the Unemployment Compensation Act. I mean, about the good faith error in judgment. Is that because you looked and there's nothing there?
Well, the difficulty, I did cite a bunch of them just to distinguish them, Judge.
No, I mean, I'm setting aside the immunity cases.
Yeah, so am I. We did cite a number of cases where a person was said not to be exercising judgment because there was a specific directive. this is the protocol we file when we're administering this drug. You didn't follow it. That's not an exercise in judgment. You didn't follow the rule. There are a whole laundry list of cases like that. This is a different case because what you're saying in a case like this and what this judge said is, my employer told me to be careful. I wasn't careful. That's misconduct. That's as much guidance as you have. Be careful. And if you're not careful, then it's misconduct. And that's what this judge did in the unemployment case, and that specifically contradicts what the legislature has said.
So if there was a specific directive from the employer, at every railroad crossing, you shall stop, look, and listen when you arrive at the crossing, and when you arrive at the tracks before you cross it, violating that rule would be a judgment call or would not be a judgment call?
Well, based on the case law, I don't necessarily have to agree with it, but based on the case law, yeah, that would no longer be a judgment call because you've got a laundry list of cases where there's a specific directive that someone fails to follow. You can't say it's inadvertence. You can't say that it's a judgment because they took the judgment away from you and said, do this. But here, the only thing that they said was be careful. You have to be careful. That's true. But why then would the legislature say, here is what is not misconduct? Inadvertence. What's inadvertence? Not paying attention. Is that being careful? No, it's the opposite of being careful. You can't use that language in the statute and come up with a decision like this. It said, you weren't careful, therefore it's misconduct. That just ignores the statute. And you can't use this judgment thing and say, if we don't want the city to pay for someone who's hurt, then it's a judgment call. But if you got a working person who loses a job, then it's not a judgment call. It's the same behavior. You got three guys who go through stop signs and don't see a thing, and that's a judgment call. And now you've got a woman who doesn't see a train coming, and it's not a judgment call. The only consistent thing is here is that you don't want the government to pay. The city doesn't have to pay the person who's hurt, and unemployment doesn't have to pay the driver. You can't have two different definitions or two different meanings to the same words. This was a mistaken judgment. There was a train there paying care. She would have seen it, but she wasn't being careful enough, and therefore she didn't see it, and she made an error in judgment.
So before your time is up, I'd like to ask you about the pending motion to dismiss. I believe that you have some time under the rules before you're required to respond
in writing.
Since we're here talking to each other, I guess it's an opportunity to. Without not asking you to waive your right to respond in writing later, but do you disagree with the motion, either the underlying facts or the conclusion of mootness?
Yes, Ms. Freilich was kind enough to call me before she filed it on Monday, and then also because she knows so much more than I do, she walked me through the statute and explained things to me. I did look at the rule 127. We have 5 days to respond. We'd hope to have things in on Friday. I visited with my client because we're not handling the workers' comp and other aspects, and I really didn't know the facts that she was putting forth. But basically, I think the facts, if I can verify them, I'm trying to get an affidavit from my client about it. She did collect workers' comp until November 20th when they cut her off. So there's a window of about 6 weeks where she wouldn't be disqualified because she was getting workers' comp. But she had a surgery on November 13, and following that surgery, the doctor just cleared her for light-duty work of January 7 of 2019. So she wouldn't have been ready, willing, and able. She wouldn't have been able to work during that period. So I think the facts that they state about her not being eligible to get any money are likely to be true. But again, I will reserve the right to respond in writing, and we'd hope to do that by Friday. Visiting with her, I think she is suffering actual harm when she has a former employer who says that she was discharged for misconduct. She's 55 years old. She's earned a living as a commercial truck driver. This will affect her ability to get a job with a reputable outfit if she's discharged for misconduct. And right now, that's what her employer says, and that's the issue that's before the court. What she did was not misconduct under the statute, and it should not be left on her record with the former employer so that they could tell somebody, and she has no rebuttal, no no way to deal with it, that she was discharged for misconduct. That's going to affect her ability to earn a living as a commercial truck driver. But I'll address that in more detail and hopefully have that by Friday. But the substance of the argument on why this needs to be reversed is applying the law in a consistent manner, which we have to do. We can't have one standard when you're saying the city doesn't have to pay for a judgment call, and another standard when a worker who does exactly the same thing is saying, oh, that's not a judgment call, that's misconduct. That would be a violation of subdivision 6B, and I think both part 2, saying inadvertence, and part 6, dealing with judgment calls, either of those would be a basis for reversing this decision.
If I may just make a comment about the motion in speaking for myself now. I think one of the most significant facts is that there was another independent determination of ineligibility, which was not challenged in an administrative appeal or a writ of cert. And so regardless of her medical condition and her and so on, that determination itself might be the stumbling block. But anyway, I would encourage you just to not overlook that when you are responding to the motion.
Those determinations, though, are for the specific period involved, and they weren't challenged because they were accurate. She was getting workers' comp, so there's no reason to challenge it. It was true. But when you stop getting workers' comp, then you can apply, and you can go retroactive for 4 weeks on it. So the fact that the first one wasn't appealed wouldn't prevent her from filing a new claim. And the same thing would be true with respect to the being able to work. She had a concussion. She wound up with a surgery. She was injured. She couldn't work. She didn't challenge that because it was true. But that can change, and when it does change, she would be eligible to receive benefits. But I'll do my best to address that when I file a responsive. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fargoni. Counsel for Deed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ann Froelich, and I represent the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. And we ask that this court dismisses this matter because the matter is moot. Ms. Bowdish was discharged from the employer on January 9th, 2018, because she had driven her truck in front of an oncoming train. After she filed her unemployment account, Deed issued 3 determinations. One of those determinations was that she was discharged because of employment misconduct. That's the issue before this court today. There were 2 other determinations. One issued February 1st, 2018, and one issued February 6th, 2018. Both of the effective dates of both of those determinations were December 31st of 2017, the start date of her account, and both held that she was ineligible until conditions changed. One of those was because she was receiving work comp benefits, and one of those is because she was not available to work. And so even if this court should reverse the decision of her discharge because of employment misconduct, she wouldn't receive benefits because those 2 determinations on the work comp and the availability are still ongoing.
Stop you there. So you said until conditions changed, and have conditions changed?
Deed has, and this was the first report that I've gotten today that something may have changed. Deed has not received anything indicating from Ms. Bowdish saying that she either was available to work at some point in 2018 or that she stopped receiving work comp benefits. Now, there's another factor here, and I apologize if I was unclear on the phone. Ms. Bowdish requested unemployment benefits beginning the week of December 31st, 2017, and she continued requesting them for each week through the week of May 13th, 2018. She hasn't requested unemployment benefits for any week after May 13th of 2018. You can only request benefits for the past 4 weeks. So today you could request benefits going into, I don't have the calendar in front of me, but maybe the last week or 2 of December, but you wouldn't be able to go any further back than that. So it's not as if you can say, well, I stopped getting unemployment, or I stopped receiving workers' comp, I believe counsel said November 20th, so I can go back 4 weeks before that. That's not how it works. It's today she would have to go back and request 4 weeks, and there could possibly, I guess, be some time in there that she had was both available for work, medically able to work, actively seeking work, and not receiving work comp. But at this point, we have, Deed hasn't received any evidence that those determinations are not still correct. Now, there is one difference between the work comp and the availability versus the discharge, and that is all she needs to do to end the ineligibility on the work comp and the availability is provide information to Deed that she's not receiving the workers' compensation benefits and that she is available for work and actively seeking. Whereas for the discharge due to employment misconduct, to end that, somebody has to receive $1,450 in subsequent employment. So that is a change which normally would not make this matter moot. However, in this case, her benefit year is over, meaning that to collect any unemployment benefits past December 29th of 2018, she has to establish a new unemployment benefit account. To do that, she needs $2,900 in new subsequent covered employment. So if she has enough money in new employment to establish a new benefit account, she will necessarily have, we call it, cleared the period of ineligibility on the discharge. And so for those reasons, we believe that this matter is moot, and any decision this court issues will not make any difference on Ms. Bowdish's eligibility for unemployment benefits, on the employer, DART-X, or on the department. If this court does not grant the motion to dismiss, as the matter is moot, then we ask that this court affirm the decision of the unemployment law judge as it is legally correct. On the point of counsel appears to concede that this is a serious violation of the employer's reasonable expectations, but claims that it comes under one of two exceptions, and the one that was discussed at length is the good faith error in judgment. Now, Ms. Anderson testified when asked what the expectation of Ms. Bowdish was, that you have to make sure the tracks are clear before you pull onto the track. And so I would disagree that there is discretion involved. The expectation is that you don't pull onto the track when there is a train coming. Additionally, this is different than the cases of official immunity. In the cases involving official immunity, the only question is whether there was discretion, whether it was a judgment call. And if they decided there was a judgment call, then that fell within official immunity.
So here, is it your position that every avoidable collision involves a violation of a workplace violation and is misconduct? If the employer says, take care to avoid collisions?
I don't feel comfortable, since everything is so fact specific, I don't feel comfortable making that bright line rule. I think in cases where you have a big rig, and you are, in this case specifically, when you're involving trains, the potential for damage is quite great. So this is more akin to the case, for instance, Peterson versus Northwest, where there was an airline pilot who was on call who got drunk before his on-call shift. It's more akin to something like that, where the potential for damage is she could have died if she had been hit by the train and there could have been other damage, than something like Dorney, where someone didn't card someone before serving them alcohol. I think you have to take into consideration
what if the instruction for a transport company to its drivers is obey all traffic laws. That's a requirement of your job. And a truck driver fails to yield at a yield sign or there's a collision involving the truck and another vehicle where the truck was at an intersection where that was uncontrolled for cross traffic but controlled by a yield sign for the truck driver. Collision would necessarily mean the truck driver failed to yield.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a misconduct case?
That yes. Without, on those facts, I think that would amount to employment misconduct. One of the keys here, which makes it different from official immunity, is that it has to be a good faith error in judgment. So even if you say this is an error in judgment, we have another level of analysis that they don't have in the official immunity, and that is the good faith aspect. And now Black's Law Dictionary defines good faith a couple of ways. Most relevant here, I think, is faithfulness to one's duty or obligation or observance of reasonable commercial standards of fair dealing in a given trade or business. And now here, when we are dealing with a commercial vehicle carrying a lot of weight, and the risk is running in front of a train or running into a train or getting hit by a train, that's a high level of care that's required.
There's a difference, wouldn't you agree, between a high level of care being required and good faith? I mean, doesn't good faith necessarily mean, relate to intent or as opposed to just carefulness?
Well, I think they're not exclusive of each other. I think in a case where you have a high level of care, what is required of you for your conduct to amount to a good faith error in judgment has to be higher than something that is trivial.
I guess I'm just troubled, and then going back to your comparison with the airline situation, I mean, I see what you're saying in the sense that just given the high stakes, mm-hmm. more care is called for. I mean, I understand that. But there's a whole lot of difference between someone who inadvertently does something, even though the stakes are really high, and someone who gets drunk before not taking care. I mean, one, you would see a lot more of bad faith
right.
than the other.
Yes, yes. Okay. I agree with that. However, if for instance, back to this case, she admits that conditions weren't good, that it was icy. Ms. Bowdish admitted that, she claimed that she couldn't see clearly, and she conceded that if she had been going 1 to 2 miles an hour, she could have stopped before the tracks and to see if there was a train coming. But she chose not to do that. She chose to proceed assuming there wasn't a train. And I think in that case, it shows that she didn't have a good faith, it wasn't a good faith error because she made an assumption when she could have taken the appropriate caution for the weather conditions and because there was this partial obstruction. And so that, I think, shows that she didn't act in good faith and wasn't sufficiently careful for these conditions.
Seems to me that inadvertence is perhaps a closer fit than good faith error in judgment. And in your brief, you cited only one precedential case about inadvertence, and that's Dorney. Isn't there any case law about drivers, driver employees and inadvertence? It seems like this general type of fact pattern must have occurred many times.
I am not familiar with cases on that specific. Dorney is the case that we found on inadvertence. I'm not familiar with more applicable case law. But I think Dorney, in fact, shows the trivial nature shows how trivial it can be to be inadvertence. And I don't think that the facts here are similar to those because the danger and potential damage is so much greater here.
So how does the significance of the danger bear on the question of whether it was inadvertent or more grievous?
The level of care required determines how serious and whether you can be whether you can, you, it's hard to say that it was an oversight in something that is critical for safety. It's hard to say that when something is critically important, as in not running in front of a train, because there is the high potential for injury or even death, to say that I forgot to look. I don't think the analysis in Dorney would apply to something where that level of care necessarily has to be higher.
A museum worker inadvertently bumps into a $50,000 vase and it falls, and versus a restaurant employee who inadvertently bumps into a pitcher of beer and it falls. One is a $5,000 loss and one is significantly more. You're suggesting that the value bears on whether the conduct was inadvertent?
The value bears on what the expectation is. And the higher the expectation, I think it's reasonable to assume somebody around a $50,000 piece of artwork is more careful than somebody bustling in a restaurant. That expectation heightens the level of care required and minimizes what could be inadvertent in those circumstances. As my time is running out, I do want to reiterate that we would first request that this court dismiss this matter because it is moot, and in the alternative, if the court chooses not to do that, to affirm the decision of the unemployment law judge. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Froelich. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. This is Michael Fargioni again. Three comments. One, Judge Ross, let me pick up on your comment. I think it's very accurate to say that you don't judge the nature of an inadvertent act necessarily by the consequences. You have a driver who's out in Wyoming, and in the field to the right, there's a herd of elk. Driver's not from Wyoming, never seen a herd of elk. Looks to the right, sees the herd of elk. Car drifts over the center line. It's an act of inadvertence going over the center line. If he runs into someone in the other lane and kills somebody, it doesn't change the nature of the act. 999 times out of 1,000, you'll see her over the center line, get back in your own lane. There's no harm.
Well, I think Ms. Froelich was talking about in your hypothetical, the driver was unaware of anyone in the lane. I think in the hypothetical that we were discussing, the employee would be aware of the value, what's at stake in the inadvertence. And the suggestion I think that's been made is there's a higher expectation of care if the employee is aware of the higher value, of the greater significance of the loss, the greater result in the inadvertence.
Well, you know, Judge,
that was the argument, I think, that was made.
And it's not a good argument. I mean, it goes back to first year tort law with the Paulsgraf case. You judge negligence, you judge the nature of the act by what's foreseeable, and if you do terrible harm, you're responsible for it, and if you do very little harm, you're responsible for it. The ability to predict how much harm you're going to do isn't change the nature of the act. An inadvertent act is a negligent act. The legislature has said not every negligent act is going to be misconduct. If you're just not paying enough attention, that's inadvertence. The other thing I think that's very important in this case is in Subdivision 6 Part D said it's very important to look at whether or not you're dealing with a single act, and you are. That's explicit in the transcript. What's the single act here? It's a single act of not seeing a train when she might have, because she wasn't paying enough attention. That's in the context of someone who's never had an accident, who won 3 years of safety awards from this company, who hasn't had an accident before as a commercial driver. This is a departure from how she normally is. Someone who has a pattern of not doing things, you can't claim inadvertence. You can't claim it's a mistaken judgment.
Well, we don't know if it's a pattern or whether she's been assuming all along and been lucky in not striking a train. That's not clear.
I think we can all assume that every time she crossed the track and didn't have a collision, there was no train there.
that.
We don't, what good, we don't that's know a, that's is a how, good, frequently that's a, how frequently that's a good she assumption. Had to stop. She may have had to stop 100 of the 1,000 times she was there or not.
But that's a good assumption if she didn't have it. There's no collision, there's no train.
The second thing, I think it's not proper argument, or it's not a correct argument to say that you can distinguish between the unemployment cases and the immunity cases because of the good faith requirement that's in unemployment.
Is there case law on that as to the distinction between the two bodies of law?
No. But there is case law saying that you don't get immunity if you did something willful. It may be a judgment call, but in order to qualify for immunity, the city would have to prove that its driver didn't do a willful act.
Were you able to find any cases where either or cases being decided in either legal arena borrowed from the other in the analysis?
No.
Negligence or inadvertence? No.
But there is an unemployment case that I think is squarely, it's in our reply brief, but the one Sharp versus Hayloft Properties, you've got a guy with a golf cart, and here there's a specific rule. Just go through, this garage has an automatic door opener. Just go through one at a time. Well, he follows somebody else in. He doesn't go one at a time, and the garage door closes on him. He gets hurt, the property gets damaged, and the issue was whether or not that was done in good faith. And the Black Law Dictionary definition was used, honest and absent of intent to defraud or harm the employer. That's good faith, according to the Black Law Dictionary. This fella who thought it was safe to enter the garage, violated a rule actually, was still acting in good faith because he made the judgment that he thought it was safe. He had no intent to harm anyone. He certainly had no intent to harm the employer. That's even more clear in the case of Patricia Bowdus. She's the one who's at risk. Her identity with the employer's interest is stronger than the employer. They're worried about damage to their truck. She's going to die if she runs into a train. She is not acting in bad faith. She's doing everything she can, and she made an error in judgment, and they fired her for it. But it was not misconduct under the statute.
Judge Ross?
Sure.
Is it relevant here that this was not a typical driving situation where somebody's driving on a public road, public street with lots of other traffic? I mean, this was a private road, right, on private property?
That's correct.
Not well-traveled, I take it. Not a lot of cars going. I mean, I understand several times a day, but...
Right.
It seems like it's not a very challenging driving situation. There's evidence that in 14 years this has never happened before.
That's right.
Which seems, this kind of accident seems more rare than a typical collision in on a city street and so on. So doesn't that factor into whether this could have been the result of inadvertence versus misconduct?
I think it does. I mean, the difficulty, probably someone who's there for the very first time is going to be a little bit more careful because it's the first time. But if you've done this many, many times, and you've looked and you haven't seen trains, and now you look and you don't see a train, you're going to behave the way you have in the past. You're going 10 miles an hour. You're going to go a little faster to get over the little rise in the tracks. But it is. It's private property. It's not. And if they wanted a stop sign, they could put it. If they wanted a 5-mile-an-hour speed limit, they could put it there because there's a partially obstructed view. And she simply wasn't careful enough. That's a finding of fact that we all have to live with, but it was not misconduct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fargioni and Ms. Frolick. The case is well argued and well briefed. We appreciate very much your advocacy today and in your written presentation. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
I will respond.